This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
A lot of times we deal with the fears that come in life by pledging to be near someone. This happens a lot of times in situations with my kids. They're anxious and unsure about what's going to happen to them, and I'll say to them, "It's okay, I'm with you. It's okay, I'm going to be with you." So I grew up in like inner city St. Louis, kind of. So being in a city does not intimidate me, but it does intimidate my children who are raised in a largely rural environment. You know, so a lot of times maybe we're walking to a Cardinal game or walking in a downtown area and they're squeezing my hand extra hard. And I'm like, "Hey, it's okay, I'm with you." And so this is how we help people cope at times. Now, sometimes when I say this, "It's okay, I'm going to be here with you," sometimes I'm as anxious as they are, but I'm trying to assure them that they won't have to walk this road alone. And while I'm aiming to encourage them, the reality is I can't always be with them, and we can't always be with others that are going through horrendous stuff in life. We can try to encourage them, but we can't always be with them. And so sometimes people think that they're all alone. We wonder what's going to become of us in the midst of situations. I mean, have you ever felt alone in a situation? You're going through something and you think, "Nobody knows what I'm going through. And if people knew that, they wouldn't want to be near. They would want to be far away from me." And so we tend to go at this alone, or we think we're under this illusion that we're alone. We're tempted to wonder how we can make it and what's going to happen. And we feel so alone and often helpless. So 2 weeks ago when I was gone, Tom preached a great sermon on how we should trust God in anxious moments like those. So I'd encourage you to go back and look at that and listen to what Jesus had to say in the Sermon on the Mount about being anxious. And then last week, Cole reminded us that we really are poor in spirit. I mean, really, there's no jumping around that. Like, the honest truth is that we're needy. And so the Bible isn't playing games. The Bible's not trying to help us cope by saying, there, it's not really that bad. The Bible's saying, life is a mess, okay? But God is with you. God is with you. Consider, like, the book of Hebrews as an example. It showcases Jesus as our great high priest, and we have this great encouragement. "Since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let's hold fast our confession. For we don't have a high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Then let's with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." That's Hebrews 4:14 through 16, if you need to write down that reference. So do you hear that? We're not alone. We have a God who has passed through the heavens and come near, who's come with us. He's with us. He's provided mercy and grace to help. And when is that mercy and grace to help like spring into action? In our time of need. In our time of need. Now, we're studying through 1 Samuel, and last time we were in 1 Samuel, we continued seeing the rise of this character David. And really, maybe the most famous revelation of him in the Bible, 1 Samuel 17, the battle between David and Goliath, it really showed us God's strength, that God was the secret to his success. God showed his strength when facing an enemy. God showed his strength in the heart of his faithful ones. And God showed his strength as he provided the victory. And we'd almost expect like chapter 18 to be on the heels of David and Goliath. We'd expect chapter 18 to be, "So David became king and everyone lived happily ever after." That's almost what we, like, if God is that strong, then man, what's going to stand in his way? But we know that life and oftentimes God operates very differently than that. And so being assured of God's presence and even his strength doesn't mean that life is all beer and Skittles. Do you know what beer and Skittles means? It's just, it's a pub term from Scottish history in the 19th century, I think, which that has nothing to do with how I know the term. Being assured of God's presence and even His strength, it doesn't mean that life is just easy and it's all just happy and no big deal. It means life's going to be difficult sometimes. But what we can be sure of is that God is with us. So what difference does it make in your heart and life that God is with you? What about your worries and your anxieties? I mean, if you knew for certain that God was with you right here and right now, would anything in your life change? Would your faith look different? Would your actions, your good deeds look different? So Jesus has promised us that, right? Jesus' last words to his disciples before he went to heaven were, "I am with you always, even to the end of the age." So he's promised us that. The Lord is our helper. He's providing us mercy and grace in our times of need. So I just don't think we're dialed into it. I think this is the reality, and we're living life as if we're all alone here. We're living life as if, what are we going to do in the midst of this? And so we choose to drift into anxiety. We choose to drift into worry. We live so helplessly. And God's saying, "I'm with you. Is that enough?" Now, it might be that some of the reason we feel that way is because we're unbelievers. We don't have confidence in these promises because we don't bank our life on what Jesus has said. So maybe you might be thinking this if you're an unbeliever, that if you can just do more good than bad, then karma's going to work in your favor. Right? As if there's enough good people for karma really to reward in this world. I mean, if karma was real, wouldn't the world increasingly be getting better? Wouldn't somebody be somewhere be catching a break and be getting better? But no, we're spiraling downward. It's working the opposite way. That can't be true. So what hope do you really have, really? What gives you hope and security in this world? And if God is your hope and your confidence, then today I want to really encourage you. I want to drive this into your soul. I want you to walk out of here this morning saying, "Man, my life may be awful, but God is with me. God is with me. I don't have to go at this alone. Even if madmen are concocting schemes against me, like is going to happen in our passage, I have no reason to fear because God is with me." So, invite you to join me as we see this word that we all need, that God is with us, from 1 Samuel 18. And we're going to see three expectations we can have as God is with us. Three expectations we can have as God is with us. So let's read 1 Samuel 18, verses 1 through 16. Here's what we read there. "As soon as he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took David that day, and would not let him return to his father's house. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, and gave it to David, and his armor, and even his sword, and his bow, and his belt. And David went out and was successful wherever Saul sent him, so that Saul set him over the men of war. And this was good in the sight of all the people, and also in the sight of Saul's servants. As they were coming home, when David returned from striking down the Philistine, the women came out of the cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tambourines, with songs of joy, and with musical instruments. And the women sang to one another as they celebrated, 'Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. And he said, "They've ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they've ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him commander of 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in fearful awe of him. But all of Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three expectations that we can, and we'll read the rest of the passage as we continue, but three expectations we can have as God is with us. And the first expectation we can have is we can expect faith from some around us. If God is with us, we can expect to find faith from some of those around us. And that's really what we see in the first five verses here. Our passage begins right on the heels of the conversation that ended chapter 17. You might remember that Saul was seeking to know who David's father was. And we tried to figure that out last time. A lot of verses in 1 Samuel 17. My best guess is that it's a tax break for David's family, for his father, because whoever killed Goliath was going to get a tax break and get the firstborn daughter of Saul. So maybe it's a tax break. And they had that whole conversation. It's in this moment that something clicked between Jonathan and David. And the text speaks of them being knit and loved. Their souls were knit, and Jonathan loved David as his own soul. So it might be helpful. A lot of times I grew up thinking that Saul and David were just kind of like these two teenagers that were the rowdy ones, and everybody else was just kind of deadbeats, and Saul and Jonathan kind of were the only people with their acts together. But Jonathan was old enough to be David's father. So I don't know if you've ever seen this in the Bible. Here's how it lays out. One writer says, it's easy to think of David and Jonathan as of similar ages, but they weren't. So here's the passages you need to know. David was 30 when he became king. We know that from 2 Samuel 5, verse 4. And Saul reigned for 40 years. We know that from Paul in Acts 13, 21. So David must have been born in the 10th year of Saul's reign. Jonathan was already fighting with Saul during the third year of his father's reign, which we know that from 1 Samuel 13:1. And an Israelite soldier needed to be at least 20, according to Numbers 1:3. So in the 10th year of Saul's reign, when David was born, Jonathan would have been around 27, which means that Jonathan is old enough to be David's father. And on top of that, Jonathan's royalty, while David's a peasant farmer, Jonathan was destined for the throne, and David's the replacement for the throne. So there's a lot of reasons why Jonathan should resent David, and yet what the text tells us here is that Jonathan loved David like a younger brother. He loves him as his own soul. I mean, imagine having someone 27 years older than you just give you this kind of encouragement, to give this kind of mantle of leadership, to place it on your shoulders. And as our passage continues, we meet the soul of Jonathan knit to the soul of David. Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Verse 2, we see Saul doing what he did. Whenever he found a strong fighter, he would take that fighter for his own service. But this relationship between Jonathan and David was strong, and it's more even than friendship, because verse 3 tells us that they entered into a covenant together. There was a promise made. There was a commitment to one another. And look at how Jonathan acted on this covenant in verse 4. He stripped himself of the robe on him, giving it to David, and his armor, and his sword, and his bow, and his belt. All of his rights as the firstborn son of Saul, he's laying on David. He's saying, you be the one who inherits the throne. You be the fighter for Israel. I'm handing all these claims, I'm transferring all the claims that I have on the kingdom over to you. That's what Jonathan's doing to David. So he's sacrificing. I mean, so Jonathan's giving up these rights. There's a sacrifice there. There's a loyalty to David. And this undoubtedly encouraged David. So Jonathan, with actions like these, is acknowledging that David is the rightful king. He's saying that this is the one who should inherit the throne. And so what drove this? That's where I'm getting this point, this first point, that when God is with us, which is going to be real explicit in the rest of the passage, but When God is with us, we can expect that there's going to be people of faith around us. And that's what's driving Jonathan's actions here. He wouldn't, in that culture, you wouldn't transfer your rights to another person. You would just eliminate the other person, right? I mean, you wouldn't make the person coming after your job excel. You would deal with that person, right? I mean, you understand how this works in the world, right? Someone's up and coming for a promotion, you hop on the gas so that you can show how much more impressive you are. You don't say, well, let me do everything you can so that you can get this promotion. I mean, it just doesn't work that way from a worldly standpoint. It's got to be something else driving him, and it's faith. Faith provokes this. In fact, that's what one commentator, S.G. DeGraff, says. This deed on the part, on his part, on Jonathan's part, was an act of faith. Only faith makes us willing to be the lesser. Faith causes us to surrender the rights we pretend to have over against the Christ, who is truly Israel's king. Faith does this. Faith says, I'll give up everything I could hold on to for Christ, for the anointed one, for the king. I'll give it all up for him. So these actions of Jonathan were tied to this big word in our passage. So it's another word we'll see throughout this passage, success. Success. In verse 5, David went out and was successful. So because Jonathan's, I think, worked to encourage him, this is one reason that David was propelled to be successful wherever Saul sent him. And Saul made him a general over the men of war. So this was good and pleasing to the people and then all the royal court. God was in the midst of this. God was with David. And as God was with him, he met someone of faith who had his back, who supported him, who stood with him. So it's not unreasonable for us to think that because God is with us, and he is, right? Matthew 28:20, Hebrews 13:6, God is with you. He's not left you just to go out in this world all by yourself and figure it out. He is with you, and so you should expect, as he's with you, to be able to look around you and see people of faith. And now in the New Testament, we know, we look to the church and we find that. We can look to a body of called out believers and, oh, these are the people that are going to have my back. These are the people that are going to encourage me. These are the people that are going to give up their rights so that I can increase because they're following the same king I am. This is what the body is. As God is with you, you can expect faith from some around you. Secondly, and unfortunately, another expectation we can have is that if God is with us, we can expect envy and hostility from some outside of us. We can expect envy and hostility from some outside of us. So on the heels of this battle with Goliath, David met Jonathan full of faith, and in verse 6, finally, the battle is over. They're coming home. The troops are coming home. See that in verse 6? As they were coming home, David had returned from striking down the Philistine. So they're returning home, and the women came out of all the cities dancing and celebrating, and they're coming to meet who? Saul. Right? They're coming to meet their king who's led them into battle, who's given them leadership. And so Saul, they're coming out to meet him. And there are songs of joy that they're singing with tambourines and musical instruments. And they were singing the popular praise and worship song of their day. And here's how it went. Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. You know, it's almost like, you know, we ought to be singing Good, Good Father today. I mean, just, this is the song that immediately was on everyone's hearts. This was the praise and worship song that everybody was into in this moment. Saul has struck down his thousands and David his 10,000s. And how kind of these women, right? After all, we've been watching for 3 chapters as Saul has fought nobody, right? Saul's been the fraidy cat back in his tent, not doing anything. He hasn't struck down a single person since a long time ago, when he first became king. And they're coming out saying that he struck down people. So David and Jonathan had done most all the fighting. And so it's almost like we're getting that southern kind of greeting. Well, bless their hearts, you know, just aren't they so kind here? God's just done such a great thing. But Saul becomes angry. He didn't like that praise music. It wasn't his jam, you know. And he said, they've ascribed to David 10,000s and to me only thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? And it's almost as if, like, we're listening to this on a record, like, Saul has struck his thousands and David his tens of thousands. And the record scratches, like, Saul's not happy. What else can he have but the kingdom? What else can he have but my kingdom? You can almost feel the record scratch. And why? Because Saul is ruling out of a fear of people and not out of confidence in God. And he's been doing that for chapters. And Saul fears, ironically, what God's in the process of already doing, right? David's going to get the kingdom, whether Saul stands up against it or not. So we're told ominously in verse 9 that Saul eyed David from that day on. And so the other shoe drops in verse 10. The next day, a harmful spirit from God rushes upon Saul. He's raving in his house as David played the lyre. And he did this day by day, and he happened to have a spear in his hand. And through the spirit, David, thinking, I'll pin him to the wall. And David evaded him twice, right? So by the way, once would have been enough for me. I would have just tapped out and said, that's good. I'm happy to serve the king, but this put my life in danger thing, I'm just not down with. You know, it's, he evaded him twice. So we don't know what kept David there as the spears kept flying. I mean, maybe the staff is just, the support staff of Saul is saying, listen, it's just the evil spirit, it's not him. You know, he's not a wicked man. If you really knew him, he's a kind, good guy, but man, his anger just sometimes gets out of control, or we don't know what they said to him. We don't, but David's there, and we have a madman attempting to undo what God was doing. And the issue is really that Saul feared David. See that in verse 12? Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him. It's a common refrain in this chapter. Saul feared David, and the Lord was with him. Saul feared because the Lord was with David, and the Lord had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and put him in charge of 1,000. But this plan backfired. David went in and came out before the people, and David had success. And why did David have success? Because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw David's success, he feared her. He stood in awe of him. And the people loved David, all of Israel and Judah. That's another interesting kind of tidbit to give us a sense of when this was written. All of Israel and Judah, well, they're not divided kingdoms yet, but one day that's coming. All of Israel and Judah loved David, and he led their military campaigns and defended them like a king should. So the thing that we have to come to terms with is the Lord was with David. So that means he never had to face any difficulty in life, right? Because the Lord was with him. No, that's not the case at all. The Lord was with David, and it didn't mean that David had an easy life. He still had to deal with Saul's hostility day after day. I mean, maybe Saul wasn't trying to pin him against the wall with a spear every day, but he was certainly raving around the house mad every day. God being with David didn't mean David didn't have to evade the spear, but God was with him. So again, sometimes we think that God is always in the easy paths. If something looks difficult to us, well, God must not be in this because this looks kind of difficult. God might be in the difficulty. He might be. Okay? I mean, and the reason we know this to be true, you might think, well, that's just David. That doesn't apply to... Well, think about Jesus and his life. I mean, wasn't that a rosy life that he lived? I mean, just imagine you're a 2-year-old kid having to be moved out of where you were born because the king is trying to kill everyone under the age of 2. That's how his life began. Think of all the suffering he endured, even before the cross. Religious leaders misrepresenting him, questioning his motives, his own earthly family abandoning him, disciples that didn't understand him, having to travel to certain places to avoid evil schemes. Like we're told, he had to leave a certain place because the Pharisees were plotting to attack him, and he had to move and go somewhere else. He was mocked. And this was all before his closest followers betrayed him and denied that they knew him, and before he faced the terrors of the cross. So God's way isn't always the easy way. And we have to learn that lesson. That's part of discipleship. We are so like ingrained in American culture, like, oh, this feels a little difficult. I don't know if God's in this. God may be in the difficulty. So I'm not encouraging you, by the way, if you're in a situation that's abusive, that you just continue to endure that. Okay? But I'm just saying, just because something's difficult, you know, we have to be careful that we're not just drinking deeply from our culture, that it's just all easy. God's way isn't always the easy way. In fact, Jesus said that his way was narrow. Wide is the gate that leads to destruction, but narrow is the way, and few find it. So, the encouragement we can have is, but blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom. If God is with us, we would do very well to expect envy and hostility from some outside of us. So God's with us, we can expect people of faith. God's with us, we can also expect people to oppose. And God's with us. Well, third and finally, if God is with us, we can expect God's protection. We can expect God's protection, but it may be unknown to us. So let's see how the passage finishes, beginning in verse 17. Then Saul said to David, "Here's my elder daughter Merib. I'll give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant and fight. Be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, 'Let not my hand be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him.' And David said to Saul, 'Who am I and who are my relatives, my father's clan in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?' But at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel the Mahalathite for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, 'Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him.' Therefore Saul said to David a second time, 'You shall now be my son-in-law.' And Saul commanded his servants, 'Speak to David in private and say, Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then, become the king's son-in-law.' And Saul's servants spoke these words in the ears of David. And David said, 'Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?' And the servants of Saul told him, thus and so did David speak. Then Saul said, 'Thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bride price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies.' Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines, and when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins, lovely, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the commanders of the Philistines came to battle. As often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, so that his name was highly esteemed." So, if God is with us, we can expect God's protection, but it may be unknown to us. This is really, the second half of this chapter is really playing out what it meant that Saul was eyeing David, and it relates to his daughters Merib and Michal. Saul offers his firstborn daughter to David, as long as he's valiant and as long as he's fighting the Lord's battles. I mean, I'm reading this saying, well, wasn't that the deal? Like, if he killed Goliath, he gets the daughter? Hasn't he already proven that he's fighting the Lord's battles and being valiant? But Saul's thinking is disclosed in verse 17. Why should I be against him? Let the Philistines do that. And so David responds with a humble, "Who am I to be worthy of such an honor?" And when it was all about to go down, Merib's given to the Mahalathite. So another plan to deal with David is foiled. In other words, God takes care of David. He protects him. Even though David doesn't even realize maybe at this moment that God's protecting him. God's protecting him as he's fighting all these Philistines to earn Saul's favor. So then we get to plot number two with Michal. Saul's daughter Michal loved David. So Saul considers another plot. He thinks that she might prove to be the snare and the help that the Philistines need to dispose of David. So Saul encourages David through his servants to be his son-in-law. And David again reiterates, I'm just a poor man with no reputation. In other words, man, I could never afford to be the king's son. I don't have any money. I mean, how could I pay the bridal price for this? No problem. All that Saul requires is 100 Philistine foreskins to avenge his enemies. Lovely. I mean, who's going to count those out? Right? There's so many just practical things here. Like, can we get any more morbid or weird? Like, that's all you require. Great. And the fact that David's like eager, like, finally, something I can do. Yeah, this is great. I mean, I don't know whether to be more terrified by Saul or David. But Saul's thought, I mean, just, we don't want to get lost in the details here. Saul's thought is just, this is surely going to do David in. This is going to be his undoing. And David, you know, well, this is something I could do. And so again, God protecting him and David's eagerness to just earn this favor, God's protecting him so that he's able to kill 200 Philistines and wring their foreskins as a payment to the king. And so Michal is given as David's wife. And look at how this plays out. The conclusion, I think what we're not to be missing is in verses 28 to 30. So Saul sees and knows that the Lord was with David and that Michal loves him, and now he's even more afraid of David, and David became Saul's enemy continually. It's really kind of a title verse for the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, that David became Saul's enemy continually. And look at, our writer has tied David fulfilling these requirements to who? I mean, who gets the credit for this? Are we told that, well, David had the skills to pay the bills, that's why he was able to vanquish these Philistines and to deliver their foreskins for payment? No, we're told that the Lord was with him. That's what made the difference. The Lord was with him. That God was enabling this to happen. That David wasn't on his own. That God was with him. And that's what was decisive. So the chapter ends with another explanation of David's success. Philistine commanders came out to battle, as they often did, and David had more success than any of Saul's servants, and his name was highly esteemed. So, I want to kind of try to explain the best I can, because I've tried to take and apply this in a certain way, and I think you could read this passage and think, well, if the Lord's with me, then I can expect success just like David had. Right? I mean, do you understand how you could think that? That like, yeah, we could just have success. Can we claim this success that David had for ourselves? That because God's with us, we're going to be healthy, wealthy, and wise. Well, I just want us to be careful in reading our Bibles. That God has promised, certainly, throughout the Bible to be with us. But I don't believe he's promised to give us success like he gave David. Okay? God was with David, enabling him or giving him success in the work that God had ordained for him to do, which in this case was as the anointed king over Israel to fight battles for Israel. God's not called Uri to that. So, I mean, a real technical way, right? God is not promising that if we go try to get 200 Philistine foreskins and pay this to someone, like, obviously that's not what the passage means. But I think we do this all the time. We think, well, if God's with me, then my business is going to be successful, or I'm going to probably be healthy, or, you know, I'm going to have this kind of success for myself. And where does that come from? You know, where's that mindset coming from? And I think we just have to be careful. David had success because he was the Lord's anointed, and that's not always success that we can claim for ourselves. So I think when we read this text and think, well, because God's with me, I'll have success too, I think we just need to be careful that we're not misreading or misapplying the text. But here's how you can think about it. I think you can, in a general way, say that there's a certain sense in which you'll have success. And here's the sense. God always wins. There's nothing that Jesus did, for instance, that wasn't a success. Even in the cross, when Jesus is dying, God was working out a plan for us. And you've won success generally in Him. So we just have to be careful that we're not roping our selfish ambitions into the aim of what God's work is. And we can expect that as long as God is with us, that He will protect us. This is what He was doing for David, and He promises us this for us as well, that no hair can fall from our head apart from God willing it. Right? So there's nothing that comes into your life that God's like, wow, how did that happen? I just didn't see that coming at all. Or else He's not God. God protects us. He stands with us. His purposes for us will not fail. David was the man of God's choosing, and he would be king. And so even when David steps out to get a bridal price of foreskins, God's protecting him whether he realizes it or not. And this is going to be more pronounced in the coming chapters as David is on the run from Saul. And this is, in a general sense, true for you too, that God is protecting you behind the scenes. That His purposes in your life are not going to fail. God's not going to look at your life and say, well, there's nothing else I can do there. They're mine, but pfft. No, He has a plan for you. He's going to accomplish His purposes for you. His plan will be accomplished because He's the King. And so we call that category of how God's going to act towards you, God's faithfulness. And I think just listen to the hymn, Great is Thy Faithfulness, and how it drives this into our hearts. So great is Thy faithfulness, O God my Father. There is no shadow of turning with Thee. Thou changest not, thy compassions, they fail not. As Thou hast been, Thou forever wilt be. Great is Thy faithfulness, great is Thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. All I have needed, Thy hand has provided. Great is Thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me. Pardon for sin and a peace that endureth. Thine own dear presence to cheer and to guide. Strength for today and bright hope for tomorrow. Blessings all mine with 10,000 beside. Great is Thy faithfulness, great is Thy faithfulness. Morning by morning new mercies I see. All I have needed, Thy hand hath provided. Great is Thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me. If God is with us, and He is, then we can expect His protection. We can expect His faithfulness to us, even if we don't realize what He's up to. So in conclusion today, we've seen three expectations as God is with us. We can expect faith from some around us. We can expect envy and hostility from some outside of us. And we can expect God's protection, God's faithfulness to us, no matter what, that He's going to carry us through. He's going to bring us to the end. He will have His way. He will accomplish His purposes in our lives, even if it's unknown to us. Now, if you don't have a relationship with God through Jesus, I can't give you a lot of confidence that God's with you. So if what you lean into when life comes at you is yourself, your way of living, your way of thinking, then don't pretend that God is with you, because this is just you going at life all by yourself. But if you give up on yourself, like even David, you know, hints at this throughout this passage, like, I'm poor in spirit, I'm nobody, I don't deserve this. And that's the kind of attitude we need to have before God. I don't deserve this, I'm poor, I'm needy. So give up on yourself and bank everything on Jesus. Trust Him with your life. Then He's promised that He will never leave you nor forsake you. And you can know that He's your helper. So some of us here need to do that. You just need to turn from yourself. You're frustrated in life, and the reality is you're just living life all by yourself. And trust in Him. Look away from yourself to Him. Turn and believe that. And if you've done that, you know that God is with us. And the reason why we can have confidence that God is with us is because Jesus came for us. He was called Emmanuel. This is one of God's names, right? Jesus was called Emmanuel. What does that mean? God with us. And because God is with you always, you can expect the same things that David did in this passage. You can expect that there's going to be faith from some around you. You can expect that there's going to be envy and hostility from others. And you can expect at the end of the day that God's going to be faithful to you. He's going to protect you, whether you realize it or not. So today, will you rest in Him? He's with you. So will you lean into that? Will you trust that? Will you find comfort in His nearness, that we may glorify and enjoy Him forever?